You're listening to another episode of Open Source CXO, the podcast designed to share insights on how to excel in your business using technology, regardless of the industry. Host Robert Kehoe is a self-taught software developer who has grown to the role of CEO. Renowned for his collaborations with organizations such as Stanford University, Nelnet, and Louis Vuitton, he continually seeks new challenges to conquer in the world of tech. Accompanying him is Don Blackburn, a veteran COO with over 25 years of experience in cultivating diverse relationships and driving innovation in various technical projects. Each week, they'll be sitting down with some of the nation's foremost technology leaders to develop an open source playbook, drawing from their firsthand experiences in the field. Let's talk some tech.
Today, we're joined by Jim Poteet, who is in senior leadership over at Oracle Health, formerly Cerner. Mm-hmm. It's my understanding you've been at Cerner for a number of years. First, thank you for joining us. And second, why don't we talk a little bit about your role there?
Yeah, absolutely. What you do. Happy to be here. I've been with Cerner, now Oracle Health, for about 13 years. Two stints. Started in early 2000s and then rejoined 2013 after some entrepreneurial stuff here in the city. Currently, you know, have a division of about 120 some odd software engineers across four different development centers, two in the U.S. and two in India. You know, working in really the financial side of healthcare from the standpoint. So leading the data analytics from the financial side, as well as health information management, which is a solution on, you know, making sure all the medical coding is correct so that our clients can get paid for their services, which seems to be a pretty important
they like
task.
That, yeah.
Yeah, they like that from that standpoint. But beyond that, you know, Oklahoma State guy, industrial engineering degree, cut my teeth at Accenture, worked in every industry except for healthcare and finance. And then after that, worked in healthcare and finance.
Now you got it all covered.
And so I've covered a lot.
Gotcha.
Over the years from that standpoint.
So how has how things changed over the last, what Oracle acquired Cerner?
Legally about a year ago.
Oh,
legally,
ago. Okay.
But you know, the acquisition went through 18 months, 2 years ago.
Yeah. So how's things changed for you?
Yeah. You know, Oracle is really a Silicon Valley company, mm-hmm. and they're really right. managed that way as well. Mm-hmm. And so how we manage projects at Cerner, culturally, it is probably 180-degree change, you know, for all of us that are former Cerner. I think in a good way. You know, Cerner was typically a product-driven company. Mm-hmm. You know, we did a lot of things that clients asked us to do,
right.
whether it was correct for the product roadmap or not. You know, to keep that revenue. Oracle is more of an engineering-driven company. Mm-hmm. So the entire leadership, you know, went from product leading and driving engineering to engineering leading product and
right.
driving what we're doing.
Gotcha.
So it's not a structure that, you know, was new to me. It was just new in the past 10 years that I'd been working at Cerner.
Gotcha.
To do that. But what it does is it really focuses, you know, on the product, the software patterns we use. Oracle Health and Oracle OCI has a very, very high security posture. So there's all types of reviews on every design, has to pass security protocols across the platform so that when it gets out in the cloud, you know, it's you know, much higher than the other cloud platforms that I've worked with or worked for from that standpoint. So, you know, it's been a good change in some areas, but, you know, we have a lot of work to do.
Yeah.
And they remind us we have a lot of work to do.
So. How'd the culture change at all? Any kind of major shifts in culture? I know they're both, you know, fairly sizable companies, so.
Yeah, more Oracle is focused on more of a SaaS-based, you know, implementation for our clients. And so I'd say that would, you know, it was probably our biggest shift, you know, in how we manage software. Cerner, a lot of solutions that I work with and around, there was a lot of open source leveraged. You know, okay. A lot of companies do that.
Yeah, sure.
You know, now there's we have a number of projects to use native OCI, you know, cloud tech, reduce our reliance on open source. There's all types of security holes in that.
Sure.
From that standpoint. So it's a good transition.
Yeah.
You know, from that way. And, you know, when you look at Larry Ellison made a big investment to get to the cloud, and they're probably the fourth, you know, you have AWS and Azure and Google that's out there. And Larry Ellison hired a lot of the engineers that built AWS and said, hey, come take version, you know, build version 2 for me.
Right, right.
So there's a lot of similarities, but it is, I believe, because of the security posture and the options that are available, it's just a much better platform and solution. So you're seeing a lot of uptick, you know, with clients and the capabilities once we get every, you know, all Cerner up there,
right,
are going to be great for the marketplace and for our clients.
Right. So the team you had prior to the acquisition is still the same team you had, or did you end up?
I've moved around a little bit.
Okay.
Right. So I returned to Cerner because I have high volume transactions experience. Okay. So I left Cerner, went to a kind of gift card company here in town. It's now called EML. Mm-hmm. Was bought. When you have gift cards the day after Christmas,
yeah,
is huge. It was
sure,
you know, 80% of the business flowed across. So we did a lot to make sure those systems were up and running. And I rejoined Cerner when they launched this. It's called Revenue Cycle. Uh-huh. It's the financial side of healthcare into their clearinghouse business, which is medical claims, remit payments, credit card payments. So it's, you know, basically integration with third parties that provide all these services.
Sure.
And then 3 years ago, I was asked to go lead our data analytics team and our middle solutions, which HIM and clinical reporting, there's a couple others.
So we had talked a little bit about how, before this, about how you manage teams worldwide, really, not just here in the States, but and how that's kind of changed over the last few years, especially with COVID. But I thought that was kind of intriguing how you tackled that change from the walk around manager,
right.
We talked about of being able to walk up to somebody's cube and talk to them, and then having to go totally remote,
right,
and then having to manage people overseas and
right,
so forth. Why don't you speak a little bit about that?
So there's a couple angles there. You know, managing people overseas, the biggest challenge is just context. Our engineering organizations in India, they have no way to understand the U.S. healthcare market.
That was going to be one of my questions, managing a team overseas like that, does
right,
understand culture and healthcare and different things like that. How does you guys do that? Like, you know,
yeah.
So
yeah.
Very
so,
interesting.
Yeah. So, you know, the key that I found, is, you know, for, you know, once we started building the teams and resources, myself as a senior leader, my product counterparts that help write requirements, for the first, you know, 2 and 2.5 years, we were over there every 6 months.
Oh, wow.
And we were connecting them to the work, to the business, asking questions. And then every quarter, we would have senior engineers that would go embed in their teams for at least 3 weeks to help them learn the software, what we're doing, how we're doing it, what are the patterns, all that.
Mm-hmm. I imagine it's also non-technical things as well, right?
Oh, yeah.
Trying to teach them how things, you know, things work. Acronyms for various things. And so I imagine that it's really not, I mean, development wise, I'm sure they're capable,
right?
But it's learning,
right,
learning everything else. So
yes.
Do you find that it was, you know, obviously there's a huge cost effectiveness in and having Indian development teams, and that's awesome. Do you find it worth it when you still have to go and manage them or teach them and train them and really kind of make sure they understand? Do you feel like it was worth it?
I do.
From a, I guess, a business sense?
You know, the opportunity, if you can get from the ground up, mm-hmm. and not only have influence, but have decision-making authority on who gets hired and why they're hired, mm-hmm. and why they're brought in. One of the things that I did that, you know, there's a cultural difference in European education and U.S. education versus the Indian education. It's all good, but we all do different things. Mm-hmm. And so we found it could take, you know, almost a year to get them in the right mindset, you know, to develop how we develop. Mm-hmm. And, you know, not to say there was a lack of creativity, because they become very creative as they get up this, you know, learning curve, on what you're trying to do from a business, and on the technology side. And so what I did is I formed, kind of a experimental team, over there. So it was, not anything that was on our roadmap, not anything that, you know, it was, I had a use case using blockchain in healthcare. And
that sounds fun.
Yeah. And I was able to get a couple of master's engineering students that they hired. They have kind of an apprenticeship in India, mm-hmm. where you have to work for a year and then you get your master's. They joined the team. It was the current team that I had, but it was really the top talent, mm-hmm. there, and said, you know what, I'm going to define the use case and we're going to kind of broad brush on what, you know, the technology is. And we're just going to iterate. We're going to meet every 2 weeks. There's no timelines. It's whatever you can get done based on meeting your normal development schedule.
Right.
But we're going to sit and talk about this stuff. And I did a lot of kind of a preceding and leading them, not telling them how to design something, not telling them, it was like, here's a general paint by numbers. You got to fill in everything else, right? And we'll talk about it in 2 weeks. And so we just did that for about 9 months, ended up building a working prototype. When the engineers came over, we presented at a KC blockchain event. Mm-hmm. It's since been patented, the approach. You know, I hope at some time it can be, you know, fully implemented, because it kind of simplifies a lot of integration that goes on. Mm-hmm. But it was my way to like challenge them, get them, you know, over this what I felt was a creative, you know, barrier.
Sure.
Because they're not here locally. They're not, you know, they just don't get to experience that stuff. Right. And then as they learned the technology, what we were doing, and enough about the business, provide them this use case that we could solve many different ways. Mm-hmm. And, you know, get into, you know, at the time it was, you know, blockchain was all the rage and, mm-hmm. you know, it was going to solve
a lot of problems. So how would you get leadership or stakeholder buy-in for, you know, you mentioned that it was a project that technically wasn't on your development roadmap, so it wasn't like critical to get done. You use it as a way to, I guess, connect with the team and teach them certain things.
Yeah.
Was it a process to get sort of stakeholder buy-in to get that approved?
No, because I, you know, our roadmap stayed the same. We didn't take anything off the list. I was fortunate to be able to shape the team here in Kansas City. Had a very strong leadership. So what we do is we have a principal engineer, which is usually a senior engineer that stays, you know, at least 6 to 9 months ahead of the team, is building the tech strategy. When we have questions, we're doing POCs. And then I have an engineering leader that actually executes, right? And they work together. I kind of say the principal engineer is the first, second, and third inning pitcher.
Okay.
Right?
Right.
And then the execution director comes in and takes it to the end of the ball game, right?
Okay.
And the model works very well. You name the system, I had it. We had mainframes, Stratus boxes, AIXs, you know, C code, C++ code, Java code, you know, we had it all, right?
Yeah.
And we had to get ourselves out of it. And so we used that structure to do it. And so while they were doing that, I had not free time, but I was working in the industry, working on, you know, healthcare API groups, thinking about transaction processing, you know, what can we do to cut the administrative costs out of healthcare? That's what the financial side is. Mm-hmm. How can you automate so that the docs can do what they need to do and not have to have all this administrative staff back right? And so this is where this kind of idea came up, and just my counterpart in India, because we had this kind of apprentice program and how we got engineers out of universities, mm-hmm. we were able to kind of cobble this off as our own little project to, you know, it's a source of pride for those engineers. Like sure. they're doing something. Mm-hmm. It's they're learning technology. You know, the day to day, they may not get the experience to do that. So that was, you know, part of the equation.
Sure. To come out of college and get to do blockchain immediately.
Yeah.
I mean, that's
no kidding.
Who wouldn't be happy with that? I mean,
Well, that's every junior developer's dream is to get into something that they obviously feel proud of, but it's hard enough for, you know, even juniors nowadays to find jobs, especially in the US, but no, that's really cool. Yeah. How do you measure that success is what I want to know. So you had this project. You did mention that you had a lead dev on it that was like 9 months out. Do you guys set milestones? Do you have some idea of they should be wrapping up this by any certain point? Like how would you measure, how would you know it's successful?
No, and this is, you know, part of the culture shift to Oracle. But at Cerner, we followed the SAFe methodology in the agile process. So we would commit to 9 months. 3 months worth of work, basically. Mm-hmm. We have 2 week sprints. And so all the teams, we kind of outline, here are the 10 things we have to do. The teams will get together. They go, oh, I can get 6 of them done in this 3 months, you know, and we had worked through that process. And so what we would do, there's kind of a layered strategy where myself, our execution director and our principal engineer, one, we maintain a tech currency list. So all the software components that we'd have, what version it was in production, we track, you know, is it being sunsetted? What do we need to do? Because we had IBM WebSphere, we had a whole bunch of stuff. If you don't keep up with that stuff, you get in trouble.
Randomly bite
so
you
we
one
had,
day.
We had a list of that. That was part of the planning. Then we took, you know, a swath through the architecture from a tech strategy roadmap and said, okay, what are we doing for tenant management? You know, what's our component? Where are we at now? Where are we headed to? What's our application services? What's our data access services? And we had a kind of matrix of that and saying, well, this is where we're at today. And here are the next 3 things we need to do that to evolve to where we want to go down the road, mm-hmm. right? And you took all that input plus any business requirements we had, that went into a roadmap. And we roadmapped that out over 6 months or 9 months. Mm-hmm. And then that would feed into 3-month execution. Right. And we had 11 teams, about 10 engineers per team. We divide that out and execute that. And also what we do as part of that tech strategy, you'd have those inputs and then we would have we'd write a white paper. And that white paper would basically have an executive summary. Right. So those above us and around would know. And then we project a 2 to 4 year vision on each one of these components that we have listed out on what we need to go and where we need to go. That was distributed to every engineer at every level. They had the ability to provide their own input. They understood, okay, now I know where we're going and why we're going there. It also was a great document for upper management so that they would know, like, here's what we're doing, here's all we're weeding stuff in. Mm-hmm. And then it really allowed us to get buy-in from our product folks. Mm-hmm. Who didn't know all the details, but they understood like, oh, now I know why I need to prioritize, you know, uplifting this service from a SOAP service to a REST service. Why it relates to my business and why it's important going forward.
Because nobody should be using SOAP.
That's right.
It's crazy to me the level of management and planning that's needed. Obviously, you guys are massive companies. So there's lots of you have to consider. But even smaller projects that we get into, there's still planning that you have to do. And I don't think really people really kind of take that into account when building software a lot.
And when I talk about this tech strategy, it was all backed by a business case.
Right.
And so, you know, we couldn't do anything unless we had that business case that we knew. And I, you know, even today, when you add up the dollars of these large teams, you know, if you're not planning that way, you're not being judicious with your money and your clients' money and and all that. And it's vital for the success, you know, of your organization from that. Because I've been on, I don't know how many projects that we spent millions. Right. And you get to the end and they're like,
throw it away.
You know,
that's what we didn't think about.
You know, from that standpoint. So it's, you know, as a technician, it is vital to understand your business. I would say early on in my career, I was a tech junkie. I would bebop around the different kind of like, Power Builder.
That's going back a long ways.
I know. It's object oriented.
Right.
I got to be in that, right? And the next, you know, the next thing comes.
It's shiny. It's so shiny, man.
You know, SAP, ABAP. Like, we got to go. There's lots of money out there, right?
Oh, wow. Okay.
And you go do that. And I realized I didn't know scratch about the business.
Yeah.
I was just all about the tech. And once I figured out, I've got to get engrossed in what the business does, how it works, how it needs to evolve. And then all of a sudden, tech side comes in to say, okay, here's how we can really impact that. And we've, you know, I feel confident in a lot of things we did at Cerner and now at Oracle Health. We're really benefiting the business and what our clients do because that's the approach we, you know, really take. And I make sure that, you know, my managers and directors and everyone else that they really understand the business side, right?
Which is huge.
Yeah. Yeah. And there's different organizations and different cultures, you know, even in Kansas City, like the BATS organization, which is now CBOE, they don't have any product folks. Like their tech leads are their product folks, right? I mean, they're driving, you know, stock trading, which is great, but it's very important.
Right. Yeah. It is. If you communicate that down to the, you know, to the every level of what the ultimate goal is and what the end result needs to be. That's huge, regardless of the size of the project. I mean, same thing in our,
you were talking about earlier about the COVID.
Oh yeah. That was interesting how you handled that.
Yeah.
And the blogging and everything.
Yeah. So, you know, when the lockdown happened, right. And had teams, you know, all over the world. And there was, you know, every state had a different rule here and different countries had different rules.
Right.
And my normal management strategy was, you know, management by walking around. So I'd walk around, talk to developers, ask them what they're doing, tell them what I'm doing. All that went away. And we had a number of engineers and other roles that, you know, weren't really doing very well, right? And not on immediate teams, but we lost some folks, you know, through that process. And a lot of times when I traveled to India, I would blog, right? And I have an affinity for the British Soccer League, the Premier League, right?
Yeah.
So when I go to India, I'd stay over a day there at Heathrow, and then I'd go to a match.
Okay.
And then when I was in India, they have a culture of you visit there, they want you to come back. So they take me to sites, you know, on weekends. So I'd blog about it. Well, I just continued that during COVID. And I would blog about just normal, goofy things that everybody was feeling,
right?
You know, during that time. And then I would say, you know, this is what we're doing in business. This is why it's important. And then I'd have some muse items on there, you know, to kind of end it off. And I started this, and then I did a lot of skip level one-on-ones with engineers. About every quarter, I tried to spin around, talk to everyone, and just asking them like, hey, this is your 30 minutes. You can ask anything you want. And if you want to, you know, talk about something else, you know, we can.
Right.
And a lot of times we did, but others were, you know, they were struggling with one thing or the other from that standpoint. And it kept us all connected, you know, through that. And part of that, you know, going through that process, you know, I wrote a blog and became an author on Medium. And what I did is I related, I'm a small town boy from Oklahoma, you know, two stoplight town with 2,500 people counting the cattle, you know, from that standpoint.
Yeah.
And my family business was the funeral business. And so I made a correlation to what I learned about software engineering growing up in a funeral business, and use that as a blog, you know, for my team to kind of relate. And so when I shifted to these new teams, I wanted them to understand what my mindset was as a software engineering leader and what was important. Because no matter how many times I could meet with them, they just, you know, until they worked with me for 2 or 3 years, they wouldn't understand that. A lot of things we just talked about, you know, are in that, you know, from a philosophy standpoint.
Right. It's brilliant. It's a, it's a brilliant way for them to get to know you without actually getting to know you, right? I mean, it's the just go back and read the blog.
Yeah.
So how often were you putting this out? Is this a weekly?
You know, depend on, you know, if code first started, it may be every couple months, you know, then went to, you know, every 6 months, you know, from that standpoint. But, you know, as events change, you know, I would, you know, do something like, you know, I'm from Oklahoma, you know, my English is Oklahoma English, right? I go back to see family. And so I had a conference call and I had to stop right outside Ponca City, Oklahoma, I-35. And there's three truck stops. And so I went to all the truck stops and took pictures of what you could buy in a truck stop in Oklahoma.
Okay. As part of your blog?
As part of my blog that went out.
That's actually kind
of
neat.
Right. So, you know, T-shirts and you can imagine hunting, you know, all kinds of stuff, right?
Oh, you bet.
But across the world, right, it's nothing that they would experience at all, right?
Right. Even other parts of the country.
Right.
You know, it's going to be different.
You know, here's,
seem unusual.
Here's a little bit about me and, by the way,
and where I came from.
Here's the funny stuff you can find that's for sale.
So what was your team's response to your blog? Like, what did they, most blogs you can comment and stuff, or I'm sure you guys have like a chat-based system. Did they bring it up often, or did, you know, what was the response that you got?
You know,
from
it depended. It was more on one-on-ones.
Oh, okay.
When I had the one-on-ones, or like, hey, you know, I read this, I got a question about this. Depending, you know, we had kind of infrequent kind of, you know, town halls when we had direction shifts and, you know, all that. Most of them did, you know, respond back and just say, hey, you know, I was kind of struggling today. This, you know, helped me understand where we're at. And, you know, I like the funny stuff you put in, you know, or whatever.
Sure.
Conversation starters too. That's great.
Yeah. So anyway, I think that's good.
Yeah.
It's been a good time.
Yeah.
No, this was great.